session number 27075, wheel 27.
Squadron Leader Leggett, reel 27. So, you were just mentioning some of the minor misdemeanours, i.e. breaking windows in the barracks. Were there any other types
of
things?
Oh, occasionally. There would be serious matters, yes. I must say I'm finding it difficult to recall any serious matters. I was posted to, from the course at Stannington, I was posted to Royal Air Force Station, Curtin Lindsay, as the station adjutant. And I must say, I think the majority of folk, they were reasonably well behaved. I think it's probably true to say that on any station there's always a one or two troublemakers, and they are deliberate troublemakers, usually. Some people are just unfortunate and get caught up in things. But there are people who do deliberately cause considerable trouble. I was just trying to remember, we did have one or two court-martials for various things, but I don't think we ever had anything outrageously serious. No, you'd think so, wouldn't you? But there must have been.
Would there ever be any incidents relating to the aircraft or something? Because I imagine.
Well,
that would
that's what I was thinking along those lines. Yes, whether anybody had done any malicious damage to an aircraft, I can't even recall that. Aircraft could be damaged by people just being stupid, not knowing their job properly and causing damage that way to an aircraft. Yes, theft, of course, did occur. I think this is probably the most serious things we did have were cases where theft on one scale or another had taken place. There was an instance where an airman had forged his signature on an official document, and of course that was a court-martial offence, forgery. That did go forward, and I think he got 28 days detention in a detention camp. The thing that springs to mind most of all was the bosun of an RAF high-speed rescue launch. And he was quite a character, flight sergeant, never mind. Anyway, he's bosun of this boat. And in the cabin of this rescue boat, there was a collection tin for, I don't know why or who put money in, but it was there. And people put in, I think probably, there were donations from people who'd been fished out of the sea. Anyway, this money was there. And this flight sergeant, Opie his name was, he'd been going out in the town one night, found himself short of cash, so he helped himself to the money out of the collecting tin. And he wasn't smart enough to cover up his tracks. And he... helped himself to the money. Thank you, darling, very much. And got found out. So he was on a fizzer, and that went up to the station commander, who decided that this was a court-martial offence, which indeed it was. But generally speaking, there wasn't a lot of crime. And where there was, it was usually dealt with efficiently and I think fairly on the whole. So,
what was Curtin Lindsay like?
Well, Curtin Lindsay was a Spitfire operational training unit, but it had the misfortune of having been built at vast expense during the mid-1930s to the 1930 pattern of Air Force stations, and built on a grass site on a fairly sloping hillside, which had no possibility of extending the runway, even if one were built. They certainly couldn't put down a 2,000-yard runway. However, it was suitable for operating Spitfires, and it was a nice place to be on the whole. Well, we're now approaching D-Day, we're now approaching the end of the war, and let's think, the war ended in May, didn't it?
Yeah.
May 44, that's right.
May 45 was the war in Europe, and August 45 was against Germany.
That's right. So May 45 came along, the end of the war in Europe, and almost immediately I was given a posting overseas, and I was to report to the transit unit at Morecambe. Where I met up with half a dozen other characters of my own ilk, all flight lieutenants. They'd all been through the admin school mill and had all done admin jobs at various stations. And we were now going overseas to Lord knows where.
How did you feel, Graham, about the war ending in Europe?
Well, like everybody else, of course. I think it was because of the inevitability of it that when the moment came, there was great excitement, of course. But I don't think we went mad. I don't think there was any great euphoria. There was. One sees pictures of Piccadilly Circus where there was great excitement and not surprising. But I think in one's own home, my home at that time was a married quarter at Curtin Lindsay. It was rather extraordinary that I had a married quarter. And it was due to the fact that our station commander, who was one Mad Jack Hawtrey, member of the Hawtrey acting family, had very liberal ideas about how to run an RAF station, and indeed he was a source of great interest to everybody on the station, because it was his habit to don what looked like a Tibetan monk's rig, a great long coat which reached right down to the ground, with big sleeves, and a hood that came... No, it didn't have a hood, but he wore his cap under the hood, so that the cap was only just showing. And these big sleeves, put his hands inside the big drooping sleeves, and he'd shuffle off out of the office, and he used to go on his rounds around the station, shuffling his way as he went. Always a sense of great amusement to everybody who knew he was the station commander, except one little Polish fellow who walked straight past the great John without saluting. Whereupon John Hawtrey turned round and called me, "Airman, why do you not salute officers when you pass them?" "Yes, I do. When I see the officer, I salute." "Then why didn't you salute me? I did not know you were officer, sir. You can see my cap." "Ah, yes, sir, you have cap on your head. So also has Polish MT driver. He has cap on his head. I don't salute MT drivers." So that was John Hawtrey. And
we were talking about VE Day. Do you have any memories of?
Oh yes, yes. We had undoubtedly we had a party in the mess. I'm pretty certain of that. I think there would have been a party. In fact, I think there was. I'm not so sure there wasn't a fancy dress party. No, perhaps not. That was something later on, I think. Yes, we had a mess, but everybody was excited and happy about it. I don't think there was any huge euphoria there. Because after all, there was another job to be done.
Did you expect to be posted abroad because
quite,
of the Japanese
not quite so
one?
Quickly, though, I must say. I thought, my God, they are hard up in the Far East.
Had you had any thoughts as well, obviously, with the war in Europe ending? I know the war was still continuing in Japan, but about your future and whether you would wish to stay with the Air Force?
Not at that time, no. No, I think my future at that time, I was wrapped up. I'd been recently married. I got a son. We were in this married quarter. It was very much a domestic scene. And I think that was how I saw my future at that time, on the domestic level. The service level had been going on for quite a few years, and I think now we were at least at peace in these islands. And this was what it was all about for the time being. Yes, I think I was a bit surprised when the posting came through quite quickly for overseas. But there we are. We'd done quite well. I had to move my family, of course, but her parents had room in the house at Kingston on Thames, and so we went off down to Kingston and installed them there, and off I tootled up to Morecambe. And was given a slip of paper to an address, which turned out to be a landlady's guest house. And absolutely typical it was. It's, right, breakfast at 8:30 sharp. Leave your rooms by 9 o'clock. No ladies in the room at all. And the front door is locked at 10 o'clock at night. In other words, a typical seaside landlady. During the next few days, I met up with several other characters in the same position, and it wasn't long before we found ourselves on the quayside at Paisley, I think, or would it be further up? Anyway, it was a boat was lying alongside the berth. The SS Ney Hellas, she was called, a rusty-looking old tub. It was said that the vessel had been built for Cunard, who were dissatisfied with it, so sold it to the Greeks at a considerable profit. No, I believe at a considerable loss, in fact. And it was known as the Nihilus, which the troops say was as Nihilus as doesn't matter. It was a rough old boat, however, off it went.
Did you have any inkling where you were going?
None at all, no. And I don't think the ship's crew knew, least of all the captain, because I can't remember going into Gibraltar there. I think we must have done. The first recollection I have is of Toulon, of all places, in the south of France, which was quite interesting because this is where the big battle had taken place. And then we paddled off down and sailed up between the Straits of Bonifacio, between Corsica and Sicily. And we thought we were going ashore there, but no, it bypassed and went on in the direction of Naples now. And we were about to enter Naples Bay when the ship promptly about turned and started sailing out of Naples Bay, and then continued southwards for a while, and then started steaming northwards. And the next thing we knew was that Taranto came into view. That was interesting, of course, because of the Royal Navy strike during the war. And there were still relics to be seen. And then eventually the ship made its way to the Suez Canal, passed through the canal, and we went ashore at Suez. A few days later, we were re-embarked on the SS Devonshire, which was one of the old RAF trooping ships that was used between the wars, conveying troops to and from, primarily from the Middle East or India. SS Devonshire, or was it no, the Somersetshire, which set off down the Red Sea, called into Aden, went out into the Indian Ocean, and we were then told there was a possibility that there were Jap submarines in the area, and that they were going to hold an exercise with the gun down in the stern of the ship, make sure it worked.
Could I ask at that point if there'd been any precautions as you were going, obviously, through the Mediterranean, because the war was over in Europe, but was there any precautions taken at that stage?
No. No, it wasn't until we got into the Red Sea. We were out into the Indian Ocean before there was any inkling there might be any action. And so they decided to see if this big gun they had in the stern would work. They went down to the bows of the ship and found some shells and so on. Brought it all up, loaded into this gun. We all stuck our fingers in our ears and they pulled the string. There was a tremendous explosion and the rudder fell off its hinges. So this is a little bit of excitement. Well, somehow they managed to limp the ship back into Aden Harbour, and the divers went down and had a look, and apparently they did what they could. And made it so that at least it would sail back up the Red Sea. So we flogged us. This was in the middle of the summer. And we'd been once down the Red Sea, which was excessively hot and uncomfortable, in one rotten old tub. And we sailed all the way back up to Suez, disembarked there, and went aboard another ship, the Devonshire, which set off down the Red Sea, and it was stinking hot. But fortunately, we had got some rather nice company in the form of nursing ladies, female auxiliary nursing yeomanry. They were. And we had their company all the way to Bombay, which was very pleasant. Bombay was the site of the transit camp at Worli, where hundreds of chaps were accommodated in vast dormitories, hundreds of beds in there. We all had our luggage and all the rest of it. Each chap had a bed, somewhere to put a suitcase. And we languished there for a few days, and then came the bomb. And immediately, of course, the whole world was turned upside down, and in no time at all, it was all over.
What was the feeling amongst yourself, with yourself and amongst your colleagues at the time about the dropping of the bomb?
Well, very few people knew anything about it at all, and the rest of us knew nothing about it at all. All that we knew was the official broadcast, which said that this weapon had been used on Hiroshima, which had devastated the entire city. I don't think we speculated at that point that this must be the end of the war. It was certainly a big development, and I don't think there was a single soul who was in the least bit sorry that the Japanese had been treated in this way. They, in our view, deserved all they got, and they'd asked for it, and now they were getting it. I don't think we anticipated there was going to be a second such strike, but I don't think we were in the least bit upset when it came, and we certainly weren't particularly upset when the Japanese announced their surrender. How we took this, I'm not too sure. I think we all took it fairly quietly. Worli was just a huge transit camp with very basic amenities and very basic food. I think we popped out every evening, or maybe every night, yeah, certainly every evening, to find a decent meal, which wasn't too difficult in Bombay. Some love. And we started to live quite civilized lives, knowing that the war was over.
What was India? What impressions did you have of India?
Well, I wasn't really there long enough to find out, and when I was in or around the transit camp. As I said, we popped in into Bombay for an evening meal. I think the lasting impression was just a huge mass of people everywhere. It was rather a grubby place, very grubby, really. But I don't think one paid too much attention to that. One had been in plenty of grubby places during the course of the war. This was no exception. But as for India, it was just a place where, for the time being, I'd got a roof over my head. And hopefully, we'd be going home. But that was not to be, and within a few days I was on a train with one or two other colleagues setting off for what used to be called Ceylon. Well, the train journey was an adventure in itself. We were loaded into what looked like cattle trucks, and I think they were cattle trucks, in fact. But they did have a sort of platform, two platforms on either side of this square box-like compartment. And on these platforms, we placed our bedrolls. We always took everywhere we went, we took a bedroll with us, which is simply a big case with blankets and sheets and pillows inside, and a folding collapsible wash basin made of canvas, and one or two other bits and pieces. And we plonked these things down on these platforms and unrolled them. And I put up our mosquito nets, went inside the net, and there we stayed for 4 days while the train rattled its way across India. Certainly a wonderful opportunity to get a sight of India, and many different sights, because there's a big difference in the west coast around Bombay, the central region, and then, of course, down towards Madras, where we were going to get the ship to Ceylon. So it was intensely interesting. I was constantly plagued, of course, by beggars, which were always troublesome. A tremendous press of people. Everywhere we stopped, there'd be throngs of people trying to get on the train. Police were always active around our carriage. We had two or three of these carriage compartments, and the police kept the throng away from them. But they climbed up on the roof of all the other carriages, and so we went on across this vastness of India. Some very interesting scenes, crossing enormous rivers and fantastic palaces built on islands in the middle of lakes, and quite a remarkable scene altogether. Very colourful. The train would stop more often than not, every few hours, either because it had done its stint or needed a rest or whatever. But in the evening, it would always manage to stop at quite a good station where there was a restaurant. And we'd all disembark from the train and have our very good evening meal in this station restaurant. Always plenty of wine. And so the train chundered across to Madras. Here again, one was confronted with this huge, heaving mass of people everywhere you went. I think we just stayed in rickshaws and kept off the pavements. And then we arrived at the little harbour south of Madras, where the ferry was going to take us across to Ceylon. Train at the other end, and to Colombo. Again, another scene altogether. Still very, I think we're still in the winter, aren't we? Yes, it's winter time. So, yes, we were wearing khaki dress. The town of Colombo seemed quite a nice place, again very busy. But I wasn't going to stay there long. I was myself and an army officer, an ex-army officer who changed services and joined the RAF. He and I were going to a place called Minería. He is station admin officer, and myself as adjutant to a squadron based in the middle of Ceylon at a place called Minería.
If you hold it.